This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On November 2nd, just one day before Election Day, the trial of Caspar Weinberger is tentatively scheduled to begin. It is a trial expected to offer new information concerning what Ronald Reagan and George Bush knew about the Iran-Contra affair. Weinberger, who was Secretary of Defense under Reagan, is now the highest official indicted in the scandal. Last week, Weinberger pleaded not guilty to 5 felony charges of lying to Congress about the Iran-Contra affair and concealing his journals documenting the affair. My guest Tom Blanton has written several investigative accounts of the scandal. He filed the Freedom of Information Act request and subsequent lawsuit that forced the U.S. government to release Oliver North's diaries. He's the executive director of the National Security Archive, a library and research institute which documents U.S. foreign policy. The archive provides scholars and journalists, as well as other researchers, with unclassified and declassified government documents. I asked Blanton about the significance of the Weinberger indictment.
The Weinberger indictment is a very big breakthrough because it takes the Iran-Contra investigation right up to the doorstep of Ronald Reagan. And this is despite a 5-year effort by then Reagan administration officials and the Bush administration to keep responsibility for this scandal away from the president. So the real importance is it goes to Reagan. And how so? The key to the indictment hinges around 2 core secrets of the Iran-Contra scandal that former Secretary of Defense Weinberger is accused of covering up. And these were arms deals to Iran in 1985 and the secret Saudi Arabian funding for the Contras in 84 and 85. And the reason those go right to Reagan's doorstep is in the Saudi case, he personally put the arm on King Fahd at one White House meeting, after which Fahd upped his donation to about $2 million a month. And then on the Iran arms deals in 85, Weinberger himself told the president that these were illegal, that they were against the law. In fact, at one key meeting, Weinberger even ticked off the various laws that were broken by the deals. And the president said, "Well, Cap, the American people would never forgive me if I failed to get those hostages out just because of this legal question." And he brushed it off. And so in that situation, the Secretary of Defense had a couple of options. Here's the president brushing off a word of illegal, criminal, against-the-law acts. And Cap could have resigned, and he didn't. He could have, as Oliver North points out in his autobiography, Weinberger had the authority to unilaterally stop the arms deals. He didn't do that either. Instead, he seems to have objected when there were formal meetings about the deals, but the rest of the time kept his mouth shut. And then when the investigators came around and asked him, "Did you keep any notes on these meetings? Did you take any notes on your phone calls? Did you ever write down what the president told you?" Weinberger said, "Notes? What notes? I never kept any notes. Wish I'd kept notes. Would have been a lot easier to write my memoirs." Now we just found out, and the independent counsel has just gotten a hold of about 1,700 pages of these notes, and they include notes on meetings with the president.
Now, the information that you mentioned about the meetings that Weinberger was at and the things he said at the meetings, this comes from information in the indictment, information that comes from Weinberger's journals. Now, what are these journals? Weinberger said he didn't take notes. What are these journals?
It's a very good question. According to the indictment, what happened was Weinberger was asked on 4 or 5 different occasions by the Tower Board, by the Congressional Iran-Contra Committees, and by the Independent Counsel to produce any notes, any documents that he had on Iran-Contra related to that in any way. And every time he said, "I didn't take any notes." A year and a half ago, according to the indictment, someone at the Pentagon who had worked for Weinberger told the independent counsel that Weinberger had these notes. He took them every day. In fact, if you add up the numbers, it's about 3 or 4 pages of notes every day, every workday, and that Weinberger hadn't turned them over. And they went back to Weinberger and said, "Mr. Weinberger, one of your top aides has said to us you kept these notes. Where are they?" Weinberger said, "I never kept any notes, and if you don't believe me, well, that's just that." I think at that point they threatened a subpoena And then Weinberger said, well, my papers are locked under seal over at the Library of Congress. Why don't you go look at them? It's unclear whether they served a subpoena or whether Weinberger just gave them permission under threat of a subpoena. At any rate, they came up with these 1,700 pages, and they're supposedly in his own handwriting, highly illegible. I've seen lots of examples of Weinberger's handwriting in all the other Iran-Contra documents, and it's pretty hard to read. But the key seems to have been that after these core meetings with the president on these two issues, the Saudi funding for the Contras and these illegal arms deals, Weinberger apparently made some notes. None of us have seen those notes. The independent counsel has them. We probably won't get to see them until the Weinberger trial occurs.
Now, the indictment outlines the special prosecutor's theory about Weinberger's involvement. Can you outline that theory for us?
It outlines the theory by implication, and that's the interesting thing, because it's a very narrow indictment to some specific actions Weinberger did or didn't do, like covering up the notes, like lying to investigators about these illegal arms deals and about the Saudi contribution. But the implication, because it goes to Reagan's doorstep, the implication is that in late 1986, as the scandal was breaking, the Reagan administration was in a panic. They had just seen their president go on national TV three times in the month of November, and each time lied to the American public. He said things like, we never traded arms for hostages, or, well, we did trade some arms for hostages, but it wasn't really us, it was this third country, Israel. And then he said, oh, all the arms could fit into one little airplane. Well, it turns out all those things were lies. And a lot of these officials had lived through Watergate as mid-level or even high-level officials in the Nixon administration. And they were just frantic because they saw everything their administration had accomplished going down the tubes because of these illegal deals. And so, by implication, this indictment of Weinberger says that these guys all got together. Ed Meese, the attorney general, was sort of the leader of the effort. And they created a kind of alternative story to cover up the personal role of President Reagan in these deals. And the alternative story was the one that we all know about this obscure lieutenant colonel on the National Security Council staff named Ollie North, doing a diversion from the arms sales over to the Contras. And they went public with the diversion. And they said, here is the scandal. It's a diversion, and it's Ollie's fault, and maybe Poindexter, but the president didn't know. And that's the scandal. And I think the implication of the Weinberger indictment last week was that the diversion was a diversion. It was a cover story. And they were scared to death that Reagan's personal responsibility for these other issues, the Saudi funding for the Contras and the illegal deals in 85, they were scared to death that would come out, and they had to put up an alternative narrative to focus all of our attention and keep it away from the president.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Blanton, and he's the executive director of the National Security Archives in Washington, D.C., which documents U.S. foreign policy. He is the person who filed through the Freedom of Information Act and also filed a lawsuit to get Oliver North's diaries made public. And we're talking about the indictment of Caspar Weinberger. We're going to take a short break and talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Blanton of the National Security Archives, who has written extensively about the Iran-Contra scandal, and we're discussing the indictment of Caspar Weinberger. Now, you say that this indictment takes the story to the doorstep of the president and the vice president of Reagan and Bush. So, judging from the indictment, what does that lead you to believe that, let's start with Reagan, what does that lead you to believe that Reagan actually knew about the Iran-Contra affair?
Well, what we had before last week was a story that really most resembled a kind of modernist drama, and there was no central knowledge or central character on whom you could place the responsibility for the whole thing. You had lieutenant colonels, and you had Saudi princes, and you had Navy admirals, and you had private entrepreneurs, and you had rogue CIA agents, and you had literally dozens and dozens of these characters wandering on and off the stage, and 26 countries involved in the Contra aid, and this and that deal, and scams, and fakes, and rip-offs. But because the core of that previous story was about the diversion, and that didn't track back to President Reagan. It didn't hang together. I think the American people were really baffled by it in many respects. The writer Francis Fitzgerald came up with a great metaphor, I thought, which was we as Americans had been spoiled by Watergate, because that was Shakespeare. That was Richard Nixon, the mighty brought low by their own hubris. And the problem with Iran-Contra was it was much more like a modernist drama, like a Samuel Beckett, with these characters going all over the place and leads that would fizzle out. And you had a sense that it was really important and really cosmic, but there was no narrative to hang on. And I think, if to continue that metaphor, I think in a strange way, Caspar Weinberger is the Godot that the narrative has been waiting for all this time. It's as if the character walked onto the stage and all of a sudden you have this tragedy beginning to take shape instead of this modernist drama that no one can follow. And the tragedy is that the president himself wanted the Contras kept alive body and soul and was personally willing to ask King Fahd to put up the money from the Saudi oil riches and was personally willing to approve arms deals with Iran even when they broke the law. He was so eager to do something to get the hostages out. And so now we've got a sort of a narrative coherency that's just beginning to come together, and part of the tragedy is that it's Caspar Weinberger around whom this narrative is coalescing.
And that's a tragedy because he was somebody who was opposed?
Exactly. Yeah. But he's also somebody who stands accused of covering up this central role that Ronald Reagan played.
What information does the indictment contain about what President Bush, who was the vice president during the Iran-Contra affair, knew?
It has information on one very interesting meeting in November of 86, just before the Reagan administration went public with the scandal, where Bush is in attendance and Meese and Reagan and Shultz and Weinberger and all these other characters are there. And Meese announces that the deals in 85 may well have been illegal. And he sort of says, but the president didn't know. And no one at the meeting, including Bush, speaks up, even though the implication is, and the other evidence, all the thousands of other documents tend to show, that the motive force was Ronald Reagan. Every morning at the national security briefing, his various advisors said, Reagan would ask about the hostages. What have we done today to get them out? There was a very clear mandate from Ronald Reagan to go the extra mile, to cut the deals, whatever you had to do. Forget these legal questions. So when you come to that meeting, you have George Bush sitting there. He had also been in a lot of those national security briefings. He had been in on all the key deals, the meetings on the deals during 1986. He knew a lot. He wasn't out of the loop. He was there when Reagan signed the Bible that they sent off to the Ayatollah and so forth. So, and he kept his mouth shut, like the rest of them. And I think what it comes down to is the great difficulty with assigning blame in this scandal to either Bush or Reagan is they both operated sort of like the Book of the Month Club operates. If you know how that works, you get a catalog in the mail. It has all the books. There's a little postcard in there. You got to send back the postcard to stop the book from coming. Otherwise, it just happens automatically. And what we see from all these documents is Ollie North and Poindexter and the others briefing Reagan and briefing Bush and putting up a catalog of the arms deals and the Contra aid every month and sometimes every week. And neither Bush nor Reagan ever sends back the turndown card.
Bush has said, though, all along that he was intentionally kept out of the loop and he never knew anything.
That's part of the cover story, and he has qualified that statement on several occasions. And I would recommend a close reading of that famous interview he had with Dan Rather, where he said, out of the loop, and Rather says, well, what do you mean? You were at this meeting, you were at that meeting. And Bush says, by out of the loop, I mean not operational. Now, that's George Bush's definition of out of the loop, that he wasn't operational. He didn't carry out any of these operations. But I guess the follow-up question should have been, well, when has any vice president ever been operational? The point about being in the loop or out of the loop is, what'd you know and when'd you know it? And George Bush knew everything that was happening in 1986. He was briefed over and over. He attended all those meetings. I think that However, you can't track a specific instance like this Weinberger meeting with Reagan where Bush is responsible for authorizing something to have happened. Instead, it's much more this passive kind of Book of the Month Club process. So I think the real ramification for Bush is just simply that it has to be his worst nightmare that this scandal is still lingering around 5.5 years later, right in an election year, and that this trial may start a couple of days before Election Day. That is not in George Bush's interest at all.
If George Bush was indeed at the meetings in which the Iran-Contra, you know, deal was discussed, can he be indicted for a crime?
I doubt it, because the only time that George Bush testified about any of this stuff was to the Tower Commission. And I think only one indictment's been brought about any cover-up to the Tower Commission, and that was ultimately thrown out. That was a CIA agent named Joe Fernandez. I think that, remember, what Weinberger is being indicted for are two counts of covering up his own notes and three counts of lying to the congressional investigators about these specific illegal arms deals and the Saudi contribution. Now, President Reagan nor George Bush were brought before the congressional committees. President Reagan did testify in the Poindexter trial on videotape. So it's conceivable that a prosecutor could comb through those 8 hours of rambling, disjointed testimony and come up with something to say this is perjury. But that seems somewhat doubtful to me. With Bush, there's not even that raw material. It seems even more doubtful that there would be any specific legal action brought against Bush. But I think the big picture is what is most troubling for Bush in his political sense, which is if the theory the special prosecutor is going with is on target, and if he can prove it in court that the top officials of the administration conspired together to create a cover story, to create a diversion from the core truth, then Bush is tainted by association, even if there's not a specific action which one could place at his doorstep.
Perot offered Iran money for hostages, but that was personal money, and he was not speaking on behalf of the American government. So does that put him in a different position?
No, it wasn't. He was speaking on behalf of the American government because Ollie North got him to put up the money, and the people who were handling the arrangements were two Drug Enforcement Administration agents. The problem here is there's a whole series of laws that say government employees can't take private money, can't use private money to pursue government purposes without accounting for it. You can only spend money that's appropriated by Congress. If you take a ransom operation off the books the way Perot funded Oliver North to do, you've basically escaped accountability. You've escaped the Constitution. And you've created this vast slush fund, which Ollie North administered, where diversions were going in all directions. He diverted some of Ross Perot's money to go work on some hostage deals. He diverted some Contra money to work on some hostage deals. And he diverted money back from the hostage deals to help the Contras. So when you create these fungible slush funds, you're breaking a whole series of laws. And I think worse than that, though, You're saying to the kidnappers and the terrorists of the world, take an American. If the government doesn't give you some tow missiles, we'll get a private citizen like Ross Perot to give you some cash. And these free market advocates like Perot and Oliver North, it's a wonder they don't understand this whole incentive structure gets set up by offering ransom.
How has the indictment of Caspar Weinberger affected the politics surrounding the Iran-Contra investigation, and specifically the work of Lawrence Walsh? I mean, for instance, Senator Dole called the prosecutors assassins.
Yes, it's really curious that here we are almost 20 years to the day after Watergate, and special prosecutors are still under attack by the powers that be as on witch hunts or abusing their power and so forth. I think we learned one core lesson from Watergate, which was you couldn't trust the government to investigate itself. You couldn't trust the Justice Department to investigate itself. You couldn't trust the president to investigate himself. And that's why we needed special prosecutors. In this case, it seems clear the independent counsel is trying to justify what is a 5.5 year investigation expenditure of $30 million to investigate Iran-Contra. by going after some folks that everybody would see as a big fish, meaning the former Secretary of Defense. And here's the core issue, because people ask the question, is it really worth $30 million? Do people really want to know this? And I think there's only one good answer to that question, which is that I just hope in some future White House, when the Secretary of Defense is sitting around a table with the President of the United States and she's asked to go along with some illegal arms deal that the President really wants to have done, and she says to the President, well, Mr. President, these are illegal. And the President says, well, Ms. Secretary, I want them done, that person will actually stop and think and say, you know, Camp Weinberger got indicted for doing this. And maybe at that point they blow the whistle. And I think that's worth $30 million, that's worth whatever it takes.
Why is it important to you that this investigation continue and that all the information that could possibly come out comes out?
It's because it's so rare that we get a good close look inside these top secret reaches of the national security bureaucracy. I mean, we hardly ever really know what happens in those secret White House meetings until 30 or even 50 years afterwards, when the historians get to pour through the documents and try to figure out, well, who was right, who was wrong, who missed this one. I think what we're about at the National Security Archive, and there are a lot of good journalists and historians around who are trying to do the same kind of work, is make our government more accountable now for decisions that it's made now or in the recent past.
Tom Blanton is the executive director of the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.